Welcome to the New Books Network.
The neighborhoods in which we live impact our lives in so many ways. They determine whom we know, what resources and opportunities we have, the quality of schools our children go to, our sense of security and belonging, and even how long we live. Today's guest, Seth Kaplan, applies his expertise and experience with fragile states around the world to improve the neighborhoods in which you and I live. He's with us today to talk about his book, Fragile Neighborhoods: Repairing American Society, One Zip Code at a Time. Seth Kaplan, welcome to the Van Leer Series on Ideas.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be with you today.
And Seth, what's the difference between a fragile state and a fragile society? Tell us why you think the U.S. is a fragile society.
Well, I work on lots of fragile states. That's what my day job is. And a fragile state is at high risk of violence, political violence, conflict. Think Nigeria, think Somalia, think Syria, Yemen, Libya. These are countries that are definitely not stable, generally poor, underdeveloped, can't build institutions, can't make peace agreements, can't keep roads safe. And so those are fragile states. A fragile society, it's a bit more complicated. The United States, I call a fragile society, not a fragile state, because the country has a constitution that's been in place for over 200 years. It hasn't had large scale, the type of violence that we're talking about on any scale to threaten the nature of the state since the Civil War. Has great companies, great nonprofits, great technology. And yet there's something about the nature of relationships that are affecting everything else. And so when I say a fragile society, I am referring to the fact that the nature of our relationships, the nature of how we are treating each other, experiencing each other, is much more fragile than it should be.
And what is a fragile neighborhood?
So that's my lens to look at the society. So I believe if you go to a fragile state, a fragile society, a fragile neighborhood, in essence, we're all talking about fragility because of the nature of relationships. A strong society or strong neighborhood, there's a certain degree of cohesion. There's a certain degree of institutions that bring people together. And so a fragile neighborhood is a place where people don't trust each other well, don't know each other well, where there's no institutions that bring people together. Just think of a place in which the houses could be nice. In some cases, we're talking about a very poor neighborhood. In some cases, we're talking about a wealthy neighborhood, but there's not institutions that support us, that bring us together. There may not be a neighborhood association. There may not be a community school. There may not be strong families. There may not be strong interfamily networks, which is really important, but generally doesn't get talked about. So how do all these people in that place, in that neighborhood, relate to each other, support each other? Are they helping uplift people, or are they constraining, bringing down people? And my argument is fragile neighborhoods are the ones that are bringing people down because of the nature of the relationships.
And you suggest in the book that there's something about American values and American myths that help create and foster and maintain the fragility of those relationships. Tell us about that.
Well, I think, and I'm not unique in saying this, but I think when a country becomes as focused on the individual as America is, I mean, we've always been more individualistic than many parts of the world, but we've reached a state in recent decades where we've defined the American dream as something that's very material and also something that's very alone. We're willing to sacrifice everything about relationships to get ahead and get that material. Could be that great house, could be that great position. And we're basically elevating that as a society and as individuals, and we're putting aside anything that involves relationships in order to achieve it. So we're not, we have no loyalty to a place. We have not much loyalty to our family. We have very little loyalty to other people. We might have a couple of friends. We might have some practical networks, but in terms of our ambitions are first and foremost. And that may work on the level of some people. It can't work on the level of a society. And I think what we're seeing in terms of the fragility of the society is there's very little that bring us together. And we are all on the whole suffering because of that definition of what we aspire to.
Well, there's a great deal of writing and concern about things related to what you say, the epidemic of loneliness, the high levels of depression and other kind of mental health issues. But don't you think there's some sort of relationship between economic poverty and social poverty? For example, fewer children in poor neighborhoods live with both parents, just to start off with the micro level of connection, compared with children in richer neighborhoods. Is social strength and economic strength at all correlated?
I think in a place like the United States, you are correct. They are correlated, but I can give you lots of counterexamples. I mean, just think, if I was Hasidic, I probably would be poor, and yet I'd have a community of great social strength. And I can also think of some very materially well-off neighborhoods where people know nobody, and they're isolated, and they're lonely, and they don't have any social support. And if they have a need, the best they can use an app on the phone. And also I could think globally, in general, in my experience working in many, many countries, and I've been in about 75 countries and worked in about 35. It's often the poor places that have stronger societies, partly because they have no choice. I mean, I can think about the warmth of people in Somalia, for example, or the warmth of people in the Arab world, for example, or the warmth of people in Africa or Latin America. And they often have they're much poorer, and they have much more risks of conflict. And yet, so in that sense, globally, I don't think on the whole there is such a correlation. The wealthier countries tend to be the most cold and the most disconnected. So there is a benefit for that type of individualism, I think, economically. But I do think there's a great downside, and I think we ought to be searching for a balance, and we don't seek a balance, and therefore we end up worse off because we don't have a balance.
You draw an interesting comparison between two neighborhoods in California with similarly high rates of crime and poverty, but there are differences between them. So tell us about the comparison between Watts, a neighborhood in Los Angeles, and the nearby city of Compton.
So I think the reason why you cannot look only at income to understand how well a place is doing, because the differences could be, there could be different leaders, the type of leadership, there could be different types of social connectivity. In this case, you have one place with a strong local government and an abundance of local institutions, and basically enough social cohesion that people are coming together to make a place better and bring people together. And another place, there's much more mistrust. There's much more social fragmentation. There aren't people coming together. And so I draw that comparison. I think the most famous of those comparisons is a different example I use in the book between two neighborhoods in Chicago during a heat wave in 1995, and somebody wrote a book about this, and it became a somewhat well-known book, is that these two neighborhoods were equally poor. And when the heat wave hit, and for 3 days, there was record heat in the city, one neighborhood had very few deaths. Another neighborhood had a lot of deaths. And what was the big difference? In the first neighborhood, there was very, very strong social ties between people. In the second neighborhood, basically everyone hunkered down alone and nobody supported each other. So if I go back to your example in California, I think broadly speaking is What I'm saying here is the neighborhood with the more institutions, the more connectivity, the leaders that feel more embedded and obligated to people in the community, the more people are willing to come together, they may look equally poor on one level, but they're going to have very different outcomes. The socially cohesive neighborhood has more social mobility, has less crime, less people in jail, and you can see the difference based on the social dynamics in the two places.
Well, you have ideas about how to make changes in the right direction. So explain your sideways view approach to social policy. How is it different from the way issues are currently addressed?
Well, again, so my book, there's a lot of books, as you mentioned, on the problems with American, the decay of American society and the individualism. And I mean, the most famous is Bob Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. And he's written several books on this topic, but he's not alone. I must have read over 50 books to write this one. And I think what I try to be different here is that I start with those ideas, and then I set off for about the 70% of my book about what can we do about it. And for me, the unit of change is the neighborhood, because when we talk about a decline of relationships, it's not, this is, if you want to be an academic, that can be abstract. If you're a person who's living life day in and day out, you live it in terms of your relationships, first and foremost, are with your neighbors, with the people around you. And I think, of course, some people, they have friends far away, they use Zoom, they travel. But for most people, the thing that matters most to you is the nature of where you live and what's around you. And so I focus on neighborhoods as the unit of change. I look at how we can make neighborhoods more important. I look at how we strengthen various institutions that are place-based. And when I say sideways, I'm basically meaning two things. One thing I'm meaning is sideways in terms of we don't look at change through the policy lens. We look at change in terms of the relational lens. So that's sideways meaning each of us with each other. So let's think sideways about how we can strengthen relationships in particular places. And on the second level, when I talk about sideways, I'm talking about we have to think about thriving and or flourishing as a country, place by place. It's not the GDP that matters. It's the social and economic flourishing in every specific part of a country. So the United States is a vast country, for example, 342 million people. They're experiencing hundreds of thousands of different neighborhoods. We as a country will only flourish when every neighborhood, poor as well as rich, has a certain level of social and economic flourishing, so everyone is experiencing that. And that is what I mean sideways, both sideways within a place and sideways across the country.
Many of us became more aware of the importance of our neighbors and neighborhoods during the COVID epidemic. Talk a little bit about how that impacted neighborhoods and the relationships you're talking about.
Well, I think what was most clear to people in COVID was you were stuck in a place or stuck near a place, and many of us became aware of how important neighborhoods or local relationships were. My neighborhood, which was very socially flourishing before COVID, immediately lots of little things began to be activated. People put benches or chairs in front of their house, and they invited people over where they could talk outside. When the weather got colder later that year, I even have neighbors. I have a neighbor around the corner. They put couches in what we call a carport, basically a covered a driveway, and put like a heater or something outdoors, and they could go and they talk with blankets and heaters, and they would still be outdoors. I had neighbors that immediately started volunteering to deliver food to people who couldn't go to supermarkets because maybe they were elderly and they were more at risk. I had WhatsApp groups being formed in terms of how to help each other. In the summertime, we had all these sort of small, like backyard camps that formed. So the kids, small groups, I think it was 8 kids in a pod, and they would have all these camps all over the neighborhood. So basically, if you're in a neighborhood with the relationships were strong, a thriving neighborhood, when COVID hit, you were well equipped to be resilient and deal with the challenges that hit you. If you are an isolated person without those relationships, I think you are much more at risk. And more broadly speaking, if you look at the difference in countries, in terms of how countries did, there's a lot of differences in terms of technology, leadership, supply chains. But clearly, if you look at the data, the countries that have more cohesion and more trust in leaders, they were better equipped to deal with the challenges of COVID than the countries in which basically people were fighting a lot of disagreements, a lot of distrust. And so I think that starts in the neighborhoods. The national level of trust depends upon the level of trust that you're likely to have with your neighbors and other people in your society close to you.
Well, you brought up your neighborhood, which you describe in the book as having very thick relationships. The residents share a religious way of life that is community based on many, many levels, some that you describe. But what's unique about an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood is that, unlike other communities that might be church or synagogue based, Orthodox Judaism prohibits driving on the Sabbath, which enforces a place-based lifestyle. How do you imagine your neighborhood might be different without the driving prohibition?
I mean, of course, it would change in many, many ways. I mean, when I first got married, I lived in Brooklyn, New York, and Brooklyn, there were so many synagogues and so many religious people. I think it's partly the restrictions that matter, but I think there's also something about my particular neighbor that's really special. And I literally looked, when we moved, I looked at 5-6 neighborhoods before I chose this one, because I think we all can look for better neighborhoods to live in that have better relationships. So I would say that the religious part is important, but there's sometimes more than that that can actually add to it. But what would be really different is if it wasn't this type of neighborhood, if I lived about 5 to 10 minutes drive from here and I know these neighborhoods, it could be lots and lots of beautiful houses. They could have some green paths, and the streets could look really nice. But I also could realize by just being there and often passing through those places is that nobody knows each other. There's no community school because you drive your kids to a school. There's no community church because people maybe drive to a church. There's no local shopping because you drive to a big shopping someplace or you order it online. There's no level of government because we all live in a big county with hundreds of thousands of people, and there's no local authority, and there's no neighborhood association. So you can look at a thriving neighborhood, and I think we're really special because we have the right size. We have the right sort of what we might say in the United States, out of New York City feel, that people are more, there's a greater level of social solidarity and mutual support. And we feel, again, you're calling me from Jerusalem. This is like an American issue, is how I would describe it. Like, we're all together. If I took away the religious element, we would have much, much less of that. I would probably be like one of my neighbors who live 3-4 miles from here, who don't have any religion, and there's no associations, and there's nothing that brings them together. My argument is that you can form, you couldn't replicate the Jewish Orthodox model in a secular world, but you could do a lot of things to design the physical landscape and design the nature of institutions, from mini libraries to community schools, to making churches more place-based, to having local government come closer to people, that you could do quite a lot to make neighborhoods and local relationships matter. And because we've ignored that, we've gone in the opposite direction, and we've basically created a society designed for loneliness and designed for isolation. And I feel sorry for people who don't feel the great joy I have when I walk down my streets on a daily basis where I live.
How does the physical environment encourage those relationships? What are some of the structures that help?
So for me, a good neighborhood on the physical level needs to have a clear identity, needs to have boundaries, need to have a center. That could be some retail stores, could be some sort of hub, should have places where people can congregate, places where people can meet. It should have lots of institutions. So even though my neighborhood is religiously based, we are helped by the fact that there's some really nice parks scattered around the neighborhood. I live half a block from a park. It's helped that there's a civic association for this neighborhood. It's helped that it happens to be that there's a small shopping district sort of in the center of the neighborhood where there's restaurants and a supermarket. And so there are some physical things that you can design places so people feel the sense that this is my place, this is my neighborhood, and you have a stickier relationship with the place and with the institutions. Community schools, for example. Mostly today, we don't think of schools as being very important, but in terms of incubating, we don't think of schools as being very important beyond the educational, practical component. But in my experience, outside of religion, place-based community neighborhood schools are one of the best incubators of good relationships in a place. Imagine that all the kids in the neighborhood walk to school and they walk home and they know their friends and they can play with their friends. And the parents likely are deeply involved in the school and they know each other. Just think of what that does to incubate relationships. Think about how many cities used to be designed or many towns or suburbs were designed. The school was in the center of the neighborhood. And I looked at some of the places I looked at. I remember I have a chapter on Detroit. In Detroit, I'm literally writing about a school, a hub in a nice neighborhood. It was a hub of all the schools were in the center and all the kids walked to that center. And that helped the neighborhood thrive. Today, we do not think of schools as incubator of relationships. We don't think of many, many institutions that way at all. And therefore, our society is more isolated, less well off as a result, in my opinion.
Finally, Seth, tell us about a successful application of your sideways approach, your neighborhood base, to changing increasing the strength of a neighborhood in the U.S.
Well, in my book, as I just alluded to, I write, again, I try to be very practical. So I'm about 70% solutions oriented, not just diagnosing or lamenting. So I look at five organizations. So I'll give one practical example. There's an organization, this is probably the of the ones I talk about, this is the most famous and the largest scale. There's an organization called Purpose Built Communities. So there was a real estate developer named Tom Cousins. He's in his mid-90s now in Atlanta. And he was an active philanthropist. He gave money to many, many nonprofits, but he was very frustrated that he could never connect his money to any results. And if you look at all the government spends loads of money, philanthropy spends loads of money, there's a huge amount of nonprofits. And yet you look at a place like the United States and the number of distressed neighborhoods. These are not just socially poor, they're economically poor. They're high concentration of poor people. Those have been increasing for the last 50 years. There's, I think, triple the number of those neighborhoods that were 50 years ago. So despite the fact that the country is wealthier, the number of high poverty neighborhoods is much greater. So what he did was he basically came across a neighborhood called East Lake in, I believe that's southeastern Atlanta. And he decided South Atlanta is much poorer than North Atlanta, partly because of segregation and then disinvestment in the years since segregation. And so basically he came across this neighborhood. He discovered that a very high percentage of the criminals for the city of Atlanta was coming from this one neighborhood, which is often the case, is that a lot of crime is very place-based. And he looked at this neighborhood. The neighborhood was in awful condition, had public housing, highly dilapidated. And he decided that instead of giving money to lots of causes, he would concentrate his money. And again, he was a real estate developer, so he understood the importance of place. He understood you need to take a more comprehensive view of change. And he decided that he built up an organization, the East Lake Foundation, which became what I would call a neighborhood hub. They call it a community hub. I call it a neighborhood hub. And he looked at how would we comprehensively improve this neighborhood? And they have They look at this in terms of a material lens, which is the housing stock and the nature of the physical landscape, things like connections to jobs and other parts of the city. He looked at this through an educational lens, which basically means they worked with the city and they made the local school, again, schools are so important for neighborhood flourishing. So the idea was that the school would be, it would become a charter school, but it would become a neighborhood charter school. Most charter schools are not neighborhood based. And they basically invested money and had a very strong governance structure to put in the right leadership. And then they looked at the idea of wellness and community relationships and social dynamics, and what could they do to bring in nonprofits and other things that would help the neighborhood thrive socially. The YMCA came in, and so on and so forth. So he took this multi-tier approach. He gave it, it basically became a 10-year plan. And eventually East Lake is thriving. It's still significantly a poor neighborhood, but because they have high quality middle-income housing, high quality poor housing, and because they have a very good school, it's one of the better schools in Atlanta. It's a much, much more successful neighborhood. And he took that as a model, and basically they created a national nonprofit called Purpose Built Communities. And now they have 25 other organizations in their national network. Again, we're talking about over 800 distressed neighborhoods in cities and more in suburbs and elsewhere. So we're really talking about a small percentage, but they have now a national model where they've made real change in 25 neighborhoods, 3 in Atlanta. And that just gives you one way change can happen. And just to, before I close, I'll just say I have an organization that looks at family and marriage. I have an organization that looks at interfamily relationships. I have an organization that looks at community, and I have an organization that look at schools. Each of these can be different entry points for change. And we should all believe wherever we are that we ourselves can step out our doors, look at our neighbors and think, what can we do to make better relationships, set a new norm, find local associations to volunteer for? I mean, there's a lot of little things we all can do to have better relationships in our neighborhood.
That's wonderfully encouraging. The book is Fragile Neighborhoods, Repairing American Society, One Zip Code at a Time. Thanks for coming on the show today, Seth.
Thank you so much, Renee. A great pleasure to be with you.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff.